Okay, I am sitting right now at Esalen. In fact, we are on a deck in Murphy House overlooking the ocean, and I have two guests with me. I'll have a more formal introduction for the radio here, but just for the purposes of our tape. Mike, do you want to tell me who you are?
Mike Murphy. And my friend Richard Price started the Esalen Institute here and formally got underway in 1962 on an old family property here on the Big Sur coast.
Okay, and Jeff, who are you?
My name is Jeff Kripel. I'm a historian of religions. I teach at Rice University, and I'm the associate director here of the Center for Theory and Research with Mike.
We are sitting right now on the edge of the ocean in beautiful Big Sur, looking out at the cliffs over the water, waves pounding in, sitting on a deck in Murphy House, named after one of my guests here.
After my family.
Okay, after your family. So Michael Murphy, one of the founders of Esalen Institute. So Mike, take me back to the very beginning. What were you trying to do by creating Esalen?
Well, I'd had the dream for a few years. I had been inspired to the vision that still animates me when I was an undergraduate at Stanford in 1950. I walked in by mistake to a class on comparative religions. Friedrich Spiegelberg, a great professor from Germany, very charismatic, and I heard that Atman was Brahman. That changed my life, and then I later, through that class, encountered an Indian philosopher, his thought, Sri Aurobindo, great Indian thinker, truly realized contemplative, and a foremost leader of the Indian independence movement. He was the first person to call for complete freedom from the British. This is before Gandhi. So I was inspired to a vision that I heard from him, that the cosmos, the whole cosmos, is slumbering spirit, the same kind of thought that Hegel had, but this was in a more contemplatively framed key, that the cosmos is essentially God waking up.
So you thought you might be able to do something to help God wake up.
Well, that was the kind of a vision, and so Dick Price and I saw ourselves as kind of in a midwifing operation here to open up a long-term conversation and exploration into all the thinking and the practices and activities that that vision implied.
So going back to the very first year of Esalen, when it had become Esalen Institute, what year was that again?
1962.
So what did people do during that first year?
Well, it began with seminars. It was awfully good. Here we were 31, and so we invited all our favorite authors to come. And so in the very early years, Arnold Toynbee, 1962, and he talked about the great event of the coming century. He thought it was the coming of Buddhism to the West. Paul Tillich came in those first couple of years. And
Paul Tillich, the theologian.
The theologian, you know, the very eminent Protestant theologian. And his message to us was that the great task of theology coming up over the horizon was the merging of what he called the circular symbols and the linear symbols, the East and the West, the Judeo-Christian march toward the eschaton, and the Eastern samsara and nirvana. The universe isn't going anywhere, but we can move towards enlightenment. Anyway, he spelled that out for us. Abraham Maslow, the famous psychologist of self-actualization, he was very important to us. For language in the earliest years, Aldous Huxley, who gave us a language to make what we were feeling more accessible to people. We couldn't have begun here talking about the Hegelian Geist or the Sri Aurobindo's fancy phrases, but Hegel's language, and it was centered around the simple idea of human potentials. He was lecturing and writing essays about a wide range of human potentialities, many of which, for him, comprise what he called the nonverbal humanities, which would include meditation, somatic practices, sensory awareness, all the yogas, and so forth.
I have to say, this is all very heady, considering, I think, the image that Esalen has out in the wider world, which is, has more to do with hot tubs, hippies, you name it, drugs, sex, not necessarily sort of this high intellectual discourse that you're talking about.
That's right. Well, the media caught up with us. It was not in 62. They caught up with us in 67. And by that time, we had been swept downstream in the heady days of the Summer of Love and the hippies, and who are marching by the thousands down the Big Sur coast with campfires and psychedelics. And we here, there was a lot of discussion of and experiments with psychedelic drugs. And yes, we have these hot springs here. My grandfather was a doctor and he bought this property in 1910 as a spa. And he'd been to Baden-Baden and Wiesbaden and, you know, the great European spas. It was all the fashion back at the turn of that last century. So yes, there were hot baths. There was a lot of LSD. But at the core of it, the reason for it, then and now, had to do with the mind as well as the body. Another flag we were flying under, and this came to me through Sri Aurobindo, was this idea of the integral, body, mind, heart, and soul, that you cannot have a good idea without really addressing all the feelings and all the activities and the ethical consequences and entailments of those ideas. I mean, that was front and center right from the beginning. So it was body, mind, heart, and soul from the very beginning. So, but Jeff here. Now,
let me bring in Jeff, actually. So Jeff, you are a professor of comparative religion. You have written the definitive history of Esalen. Where do you think Esalen fits into, let's say, the history of modern spirituality?
I think it's at a kind of origin point for a lot of things that people see in the public today. I mean, a lot of the things that Esalen stood for in the early 60s, like yoga, meditation, the discussion between science and spirituality, being spiritual but not religious, those were all the banners that were flying here in the early 60s, but they were flying virtually nowhere else. And now, of course, they're flying everywhere. So I think a lot of things people assume about alternative religious streams in America actually maybe not began here, but they were catalyzed and supercharged here in the 60s and 70s.
You, in the subtitle of your book, you talk about the religion of no religion. What does that mean?
Well, that was Frederick's phrase. You know, I'm very fond of Frederick. He was a fellow...
Frederick?
Spiegelberg. Never knew the man, but he was a fellow professor of comparative religion. He did what I do, and that was his phrase. He was a reader of Heidegger and German philosophy and Latin mystical theology, and so he's a very smart guy. But the phrase was based on a mystical experience he had in 1917, walking through a wheat field when he was in school. And basically what happened was he was just walking through a wheat field, and the entire universe manifested as a living thing to him. He had an experience of cosmic mind within the natural world. And it just blew his mind, as we say. And as he was walking, kind of swimming in this cosmic mind, he came upon a little church, and he heard this music inside it. And he just was appalled because he didn't understand how that little building and that little tradition could encompass this cosmic being he had just known in the entire physical universe. And so he developed this notion of the religion of no religion was a way of affirming the religious traditions as manifestations of this cosmic being, but also as relativizing all of them. None of them can be ultimately true. They're artistic expressions of this cosmic painter. And so it was this paradoxical affirmation and denial of religion at the same time for him.
So Mike, let me turn to you then. So do you feel like what happens at Esalen is based on any particular spiritual religion, or is it a bit of a grab bag?
Well, it's, we're asked that all the time. I'm, So I have to give a little bit complex answer. What drives me, and I think ultimately drives the spirit of this place, is explicitly the religion of no religion. In other words, it's a turn away for a lot of people who come here. I would say most. A turn away from something and towards something.
Turning away from organized institutional religion.
Yes, whatever it is. Now, most of the people come here, their roots are either Jewish or Christian. But they come from other parts of the world as well. I mean, people have been here from now more than 120 countries. This has been going on 52 years. So, okay, wherever you're turning away from, you're turning toward this being that Friedrich Spiegelberg, my teacher, felt. That spirit, that immanence of the divine in everything. But away from, for example, in the early years here, it was impossible for us to keep a crucifix on this property. I mean, people would leave crucifix and they would disappear.
As in, people were offended by
the criticism? Yes, they were offended. Now, they would leave the Buddhas here because, so in other words, there was a revolutionary impulse here, whether we liked it or not. Now, that's the reason we started it. So Dick Price and I used to say we're midwives to this thing because it was, wow, okay, you asked for it. Say, here you're getting it. This was a whole, in the beginning, you could say it was a subculture. Ted Rozak called it a counterculture. But then, pretty soon, it was, you know, a lot of the people here are actually Republicans. There are a lot of atheists who turn out to be crypto mystics. Some of the leaders here, Fritz Perls and others, were dedicated atheists. But in their private moments, they talked as if with tongues in a learned language of mysticism, so that what was emerging was bigger than any particular formulations. So we've had to match the largeness of the spirit, the largeness, see that the Germans sometimes, their words worked a little better. I mean, the Geist, you know, which can be the mind, the spirit, the soul. The soul of this culture was emerging, so we had to find the language and the practices to match it and to help give it birth. And that's really been driving this for 52 years. Now, there's hundreds of particulars about all of this, and because it leads, I mean, just to make a long leap, it led us straight over to Russia right away. And so we got very involved in Russian-American relations. So it's a long leap from Indian philosophy and Atman Brahman to Russian-American relations, but for us, it's been of a piece. It's this set of profound entailments that come once you start on this path. I mean, these things are connected. So there's a lot to say.
Yeah. Well, let me turn to our scholar of comparative religion here. Mike was just talking about how atheists come here and then have mystical experiences. What do you make of that?
Well, you don't need God to have a mystical experience. And of course, a lot of mystical traditions are deeply critical of images of God as some kind of separate being out there, like another person. So to me, it's not incompatible at all.
Mm-hmm. And what about the criticism that I guess is leveled against a lot of what's passed off as New Age spirituality, you know, cafeteria spirituality? Just have a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Doesn't go very deep. You know, it's people who dabble. Is it fair to tar Esalen with that charge?
You know, I think that comes from a conservative place, conservative philosophically, that it comes from a place that wants to preserve the traditions as sort of silos, self-preserved silos that have nothing to do with one another. And I think what Esalen has done, which frankly wasn't new in the culture, you know, the transcendentalists were doing this already in the middle of the 19th century. Once you locate religious authority in the human person, once you identify an immanent God, there's nothing to stop the individual from picking and choosing whatever he or she wants. Because then the authority doesn't lie out in this tradition or that scripture or that priest or that authority. It lies inside. And so it's a logical extension of this mystical theology. It makes perfect sense. And I think when people resist that, they're correctly seeing how radical it is. I think they're right to resist it if they want to preserve their worlds as they've been.
So you regard, I mean, as a historian of religion and specifically a historian of Esalen, you see this place and all that it's done over the last 50 years as as having an important impact on, what, American culture?
Yeah, I think important's an understatement. I mean, I think it's had an immense influence, largely indirect, largely invisible. I mean, it was a very visible influence in the 60s and the early 70s, but since then I think it's primarily been indirect. Tens of thousands of people are coming here and being influenced in some subtle way, meeting someone, meeting an idea, a book, and then going out and doing things in the world. So I think it's a kind of, it's the center of a web that's spun very, very far and through space and time.
And one thing that Esalen has been identified with is being a key part of what was called the Human Potential Movement, probably back in the 1970s in particular. And Mike, you were there at the vanguard of this. So what does human potential mean to you?
Well, first of all, it was the language that we adapted from Aldous Huxley. In our earliest brochures and our earliest conversations to talk about what we were doing. You know, if I had used the language of, say, Sri Aurobindo and talked about the, quote, descent of the supermind, which in certain ways I don't even believe in, because I have not bought all of Aurobindo. This is a single person. He probably had, well, he definitely had the most influence, but I have consciously rejected certain parts, which I remain agnostic about, and I think on some things he was wrong. So anyway, if I used some of his language, that wouldn't have worked. If I talked the language of German idealism and, you know, the dialectic of the Geist and all, I mean, nobody would have come. I mean, it was, you know, so this was a beautiful, clear, very clear language of Aldous Huxley. He was a wonderful writer, and he had a comprehensive way. So that's where the phrase, then the language, then George Leonard, who happened to be the West Coast editor for Look magazine in 65, he and I met and became very close in the way I was with Dick Price. And
Dick Price, who tragically died.
Yes, in 1984, Dick was killed.
1985.
Fall of 1985. But George Leonard and I met in 1965. And he happened by coincidence to be doing an entire issue of Look magazine, which was it, Look and Life then, everybody read, it 40 million readers or whatever, on human potentialities. And people kept saying, well, you better go down the coast to this motel down there, and because this is what they're doing. So he started to hear about this. So we met, and it was, love at first sight. I mean, we bonded, and he was a wonderful writer. It could be that he invented the phrase the human potential movement. He thought it happened one night. I remember the night he was talking about where we were trying to characterize it. He was very involved in the civil rights movement, so he said, this is the human potential movement. So either he and I, or maybe someone else, I don't know, coined this term, and then it caught on. It mainly caught on in the media. So it was a projection of the media. But then the problem soon arose. Is Scientology part of the human potential movement? We said, absolutely not.
Yeah, well, what do you keep out? Right.
Yeah, I mean, because when we started this, we were against anyone capturing the flag. Because, you see, this thing of the traditions, but it's not just Christianity and Judaism and Buddhism. There are a lot of isms. You know, there's so many paradigm wars in the whole enterprise of addressing our greater life, the greater life that awaits us. And so we called it No One Captures the Flag. We wanted to keep an open conversation, an open exploration. We were going into the undiscovered country. And don't tell us, a big guy, that and only that is it. Dick and I both were carrying a revolutionary charge. And I have to admit, we were there for loving everybody, but we were always prepared for a good fight. And we had to have it to keep the thing open. So, okay.
So what does that mean at a personal level, human? I mean, what potential might be buried that you, Esalen, is hoping to bring out?
Sure. Okay. If I'm going to talk about my core belief, it's the hidden divinity. That would be, for me, more resonant than saying, I need to develop my sensory potentials, which are very big here, all the training of the senses. Or let's say, to broaden my emotional repertoire. That's the language of the 60s, that we're stuck. Fritz Perls, a great teacher here, you know, people say, well, Fritz, you never talk about good manners. He says, I spit on your manners. And he came out of Wilhelm Reich. People are imprisoned. We create prisons so that our parents and our priests will approve of us. And so then we suffer these horrible neuroses and resentments for, here's someone over there having a good time, having a richer life. I'm mad as hell as him over here. I mean, it's the old Puritan affliction. But this is writ large across the human race. We're all being constantly shaped up to fit the culture we're born into. So this was a enterprise in self-inquiry with an eye toward expanding inquiry. So now this kind of language, and then also to liberate the imagination. Imagination ain't just being able to have a lot of fancy ideas. It's a full-bodied thing. When you really imagine things, you feel it up and down your body. Every musician, every writer knows this.
So partly what you're talking about is we have these proclivities, talents within us, but perhaps they haven't been expressed as fully as they might.
That's right. I mean, and that's, now that is a very portable truth. I mean, it's very easy to say it and people get it right away. It's to be more. And in that way, and Jeff's written beautifully about this, it's very American. George always emphasized this. I mean, it's exactly what Emerson and Thoreau and Whitman were talking about. It's de Tocqueville describing America. All these Americans, when they left Europe, it wasn't just that they left a geographical location. They left a character structure, freedom, flexibility, exploration. West, young man.
Jeff, is the idea of human potential, is this a distinctly American idea?
Well, I think the way it's explored here is, I think as a kind of really basic metaphysical idea, it's not American, of course, it's universal. I mean, the religious traditions are basically about the simple notion that reality is much more than you see and think, and that the human being ain't what you think it is. And I think that what makes it that search American here is just the kind of no-rules approach to how to get that human divinity online, as it were. And I think the other thing that makes it uniquely American here, it's not simply that the human potential hasn't been expressed, it's actually that it's been actively repressed. And so this kind of resistance to any kind of authority, this kind of individual freedom fighting that is somehow given a certain nuance in American culture, I think is really important here. And so the question becomes, how do you trick that human divinity to showing itself when it's been so rigorously shut down for so many reasons, some of which actually may be good reasons, you know? So that's the challenge.
Now, we've been talking about all of this kind of at a pretty heady level, and I think we got to get some stories here. And I know there are 52 years worth of stories, but if you could just mention maybe one or two anecdotes that to you express the spirit of Esalen, what you do that's kind of distinctive, that puts it on the map. What comes to mind?
Well, maybe this is a too gaudy a headline, but we've had KGB and CIA guys here in the Murphy House discussing Russian-American relations, and then go to the hot baths together, and then suddenly seeing the depth of common ground, common humanity. And it struck home to me once when one of these CIA guys took me out on the porch and we were having these discussions. And he says to me, Mike, come here, this is urgent. And I could tell he was beside himself, he was trembling. He said, see that guy over there? One of these KGB guys. I said, yeah. He said, let me just say something. He's an actual human. So I said, absolutely, absolutely. He said, no, you don't understand me. He's an actual human. Now, I could see he was beside himself. He was outside himself. For him, it was a tumbling down of a lot of preconceptions. And I'll never forget that. And I wrote a little essay on this, Russian-American friendship as an altered state of consciousness, because then he has to decide who he is in his life work. If he goes home and they hear about this, they say, oh, he's been turned. Esalen's turned him, you know, in the KGB sense. So that breakout that then leads to enormous political thing in that case, because we're not communists. We were just for getting to know each other and peace, not war. So that kind of revolutionary flip happened a lot in the 60s.
I have to, just to follow up on this, I'm curious if this kind of thing ever came here. I know there were experiments in parapsychology among the military. KGB did this. Apparently, the U.S. government funded some of these things, too.
Not apparently. They did.
They did. Did any of that happen? Did any of those people come through Esalen who were doing these?
Yeah, most of them.
Most of them. There weren't that many. So I would say 80% of them on both sides.
Wait, the Russians trying to do their paranormal psychology experiments, they were here too?
I went to Russia first in 1971, and we conducted the first telepathy experiments between Moscow and San Francisco with one of the most famous telepathists, Karl Nikolaev. So that was 1971. And then
So height of the Cold War here.
Oh yeah. And then I wrote a novel about all this. It's filled. Everything in it actually happened somewhere. I spun the story up and made it up. But, yeah, we were in the middle of it. Russell Targ was at the center, you know, SRI International. Russell, to this day, says they wouldn't have started if I hadn't asked him to take my place giving a talk at Grace Cathedral, because we did our programs in Grace Cathedral a lot in San Francisco. So I couldn't make it. He spoke, and a guy came who was working with Wernher von Braun.
The rocket scientist.
Right. So he introduced him to Wernher von Braun, and they started thinking and talking about all this, because Wernher von Braun was a little alarmed that the Russians were now getting into parapsychology. I know this sounds far-fetched, but it's true. The truth is sometimes stranger than fiction. And so from the very beginning, we knew the players. We had many things going on here. Let me tell you, a lot was discovered that way, but one of the things that was discovered is this stuff doesn't work if you're going to really try to track nuclear devices. Because for every hit you get, something's wrong, and you can't make any mistakes in nuclear dealings with. So it was, I have to argue, an immensely expensive failed experiment on both sides. But at least, see, we've been able to broker not only revelations to the upside, but also to the downside. I mean, to show things that don't work. I mean, isn't that fair to say? Things that do work and don't work when it comes to the practices that nurture this larger realization and disclosure and expansion of who we are. But there's a lot of wrong turns that can be taken. And I think it's very important for Esalen to keep telling people what we've learned along the way.
So, Jeff, any particular stories that just jump out at you that somehow express the essence of this place?
Yeah, I think one of the things we haven't talked about is I think a lot of people come to Esalen for healing. It's a pilgrimage spot for people in transition or suffering. And one of the things we have here that is so good is something called the Work Scholar Program, where people come for a month and they work in the gardens or the cabins or the kitchen, and then they take a class with a resident teacher. And I've taught a couple of those. And one of them I taught years ago was called Sex of the Spirit, and it was on the relationship between human sexuality and the religious traditions. And the basic idea was to help people understand why they come into conflict with the religious traditions around gender and sexuality issues. I wasn't pushing a particular view, but I just wanted people to understand where the conflicts come from. And I made the mistake, or had the genius move, depending on your read, of starting the month with, I thought this would take one or two nights of having people tell their story. And there was about 20, 25 people in the room. And this went on for over a week, you know.
Telling their sexual stories.
Well, not just their sexual stories. It was their life in the prism of their own religious tradition and their own experience of human sexuality. And what was so remarkable is almost down to the last one, they were tearjerkers. I mean, there might have been two people in the room who hadn't been deeply wounded by their faiths, frankly, around these issues. And so the month became a way of helping them to see where those teachings come from, why they don't work today, how they're embedded in cultures that existed thousands of years ago. And I think it's fair to say it was very healing. Not because I'm a therapist, but because it gave them this amazing space to explore these memories and these things that they could never explore in any other context. And I think that's the genius of the place. It's a kind of free space or a kind of no space where anything can go on.
Mike, as we've said, Esalen has been around now for over half a century. What are you proudest of in terms of what this place has been about?
Well, I'd have to put on the top shelf, there's a lot of things up on the top shelf. I'm very proud of our role in Russian-American affairs. I'm very proud that we've been able to keep growing.
You're saying you're not just stuck back in the 60s.
Right, that we can keep going. We can learn from our mistakes, because in the early days, the place was explosively creative. But I have to say, in spite of our governance, because first of all, we weren't business guys. We didn't have any fixed theory of governance. We didn't feel fully entitled to own our leadership. So we kept, our default position was, quote, something called consensus. Well, nobody's been able yet to give me a definition that can hold more than about 10 minutes on what exactly consensus is. And we experimented with all this. Anyway, we've kept going through thick and thin. And through the tumult of the 60s, and we've learned a lot. So I'm very proud that we can, that we've endured and kept developing. And right now we're facing a big set of new possibilities. Jeff here is going to become our new chairman of the board.
So Jeff, you are not just a scholar, you are in the power structure of Esalen.
No, I've gone native, definitely. long time ago.
Yeah. Well, Jeff, let me turn to you as someone who did look into the history of the Esalen Institute. What was the biggest surprise for you? What did you discover that maybe you didn't know before?
Remember, I'm an intellectual. I love books. I read, and I think the biggest surprise for me was how incredibly intellectual the origins were. You know, I had the same assumptions in my head that every other American who's heard of the place. I thought it was a kind of New Age spa. And what I learned was that, that's here. The hot tubs are great. It definitely is tied into the New Age movement. But it began really with academics. It began with people like Aldous Huxley and Frederick Spiegelberg and Abraham Maslow and Timothy Leary. And, you know, even the really wild psychedelic stuff, it begins at Harvard. So I was sort of happily shocked by that there was a deep intellectual grounding to the place, and then there were roots that stretched back deep in American history that made it a real American story, and that's why I spent all those years writing that book, as I thought that other American story was worth telling, and so that's what I tried to bring to the table, is that deeper story.
And I just want to follow up on this sense of an American story. So it sounds like you're saying that a place like Esalen really wouldn't happen somewhere else in another country. I mean, I'm sure there are sort of versions of it, but there's something distinctly American about this place.
Well, I think so, obviously.
Yes, it's obviously a very American story, but it's rooted in a global story. And we're very much part of the global village. People have been here from 120 countries and coming groups from Japan and China and Sweden and all over the place. A lot of people from Brazil. So this is a worldwide awakening to a new vision of God and the evolving universe.
But I guess I am, which I certainly understand, but I'm interested in sort of the American piece of that. I mean, sort of going back to American, particularly American spiritual traditions, because my sense is that's such a strong part of this.
Well, I would say you get a big head start being American. And, of course, we had a supercharged head start being out here in California. I inherited this property, but if this had been back east in those years, it wouldn't have taken off like it did here. California, you know, a lot of folks in New York says, well, California proposes and New York decides. You know, Silicon Valley. A lot of analogies between the cultural space in which Esalen's embedded in Silicon Valley. So what is it that's American? First of all, California is, you could say, almost hyper-American in this respect of, first of all, flexibility, not as deeply rooted in older traditions. Secondly, this passion for freedom and a passion for exploration. This go west young man, coming west. And it was funny, both Walt Whitman and Thoreau, both in their separate ways, said, when America really settles California, Walt Whitman in Under the Redwood Trees, he was going to write a second big book along with Leaves of Grass, A Passage to India. That got incorporated into Leaves of Grass. But standing under these redwoods, he said, now, it's no longer geographical. It's like these trees. We're going to have to grow up toward the sky and down into the roots of the earth. This is Whitman talking. The same with Thoreau. He tucked away in his journals is this same vision that once we get out there, then there would be some historic inflection. They anticipated it. So all of that was certainly in the air in the 60s and continues to this day. So we have the advantage of the flexibility, the freedom, the adventurous spirit, this urge to explore. And another sense is, and this is right away, we had a lot of European leaders coming in here right from day one, Fritz Perls, so many. And there was, I began to notice a difference between the American teachers and the Europeans. The Europeans usually came with far more intellectual and cultural range and depth, typically. But they would tighten up alarmingly often when the experiential would break out. I would say the more pragmatic. So when it came to the real practices, Americans typically, now this is a big generalization, are more adventurous, have been more adventurous here. And I started to call it the Moses complex. I could tell you many stories in the sense that Moses could lead the people to the promised land, but he couldn't go in. So his brother Aaron had to lead the people of Israel down in to the promised land. And so I'll never forget one of these very eminent, he was actually a British philosopher, standing above the deck by our lodge, because by this point we're starting to have two seminars at a time. So he was talking about the future evolution of humankind. So down on the deck was a whole workshop going on that was Neo-Reichian, so breaking through the character armor. So you had people in various positions and releasing emotions and all, and he stood there, and I watch him, and he just started to giggle. And he couldn't bring himself to walk down for breakfast there. He saw these people, in various positions, lotus position, whatever, and shaking and whatever. And those are wild days. And so he turned and walked back to his room and had to make a decision. Can I go down there and have breakfast? And it was the kind of the most, I thought of Moses. He couldn't go into the promised land. This happened enough that I started to talk about it. This would be middle to late 60s. So again, that American experimental go-for-it spirit. And the same, there's a book called Regional Advantage, comparing Silicon Valley to Route 128 there at Harvard. They had a head start back there before it was fostered largely by Stanford up here, places like Hewlett-Packard and all. But there's a powerful analogy between that and the cultural space that Esalen inhabits, between Silicon Valley.
How so?
Well, in this flexibility and go-for-it spirit, and more ability really to cooperate.
And also, we know that a lot of those early Silicon Valley pioneers took psychedelics.
Well, there was a lot of concourse between the two communities, and still is. But, these are quite different worlds, too. I mean, these are the high-tech, there are important differences in the two communities, but the similarities have to do with this flexibility, freedom, pragmatism, and at the end of the day, more ability to cooperate. Europe is soaked in blood for centuries of these wars and all. And Americans, although we've I mean, there's more in our DNA of how to cooperate. And so these big organizations, you think now Apple or Google, why didn't that happen on Route 128? There was Harvard and MIT. Why? And this book, Regional Advantage, people should read it. And I take it to heart in when we went to Russia, because they haven't crossed their Rubicon yet. And they, well, that's another story. They've got to get to be a little more American in that sense of cooperating. But it's interesting that this individualism accompanies a capacity for cooperation. And I think it's because at the individualism here, you realize more of yourself and you can get rid of a lot of the resentments. The Puritan spirit, behind every Puritan is a ton of resentment about that person over there having too much pleasure over there. We've got to do something about it. He's having too good a time. We must deal with him. This is Europeans have a thing about our relation to sexuality, to eating and drinking. I mean, everything. I mean, you know, so America is slowly but surely becoming more Mediterranean, let's say. All of that and more is in the mix around this.
Well, I want to get, Jeff, your take on that. The fact that this is in California, how important is that? This whole, not just this place physically, but the spirit.
I think the spirit of a place is a real thing, and I think it's really important that we're on the coast here, and, you know, we're tipping over into the Pacific. You know, I grew up in a small farming community in Nebraska. The Oregon Trail was 2 miles away, and the motto of the state was, where the West begins. And it's very obvious to me that this is where the West ends and morphs into something else, you know? So I think Mike's right about that. I think there is something not just uniquely American about the human potential movement, but also something deeply Californian. I suppose the other thing I would say is, in terms of the American question, is, you know, these sorts of ideas and practices and experiences are not new, nor are they restricted to American culture or even European culture. They're universal. They go back as far as time as we can see. But in every other time period in culture, there were not legal and political structures in place to protect people who had these ideas and wanted to express these practices. And here, if you really think about it, you know, the Constitution, the First Amendment, is the religion of no religion. You know, anybody can have any kind of religious belief system or practice because there is no official religion. And I think that we can't underestimate that legal and political structure that allows a place like this to flourish.
I mean, one of our founders is Thomas Jefferson. I mean, the wall of separation between church and state. I mean, and we've had to fight that one out a lot over these, particularly in the first 20 years. So, amen. Thank God for the Constitution and the Bill of Rights.
Thank you both, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you, Steve.
That was great. Thanks.
Good.
So you got him going.
Yeah, I did.
Know, we have a new tagline for the Institute. We're helping God wake up. There you go. And I thought of you, too.